You're listening to The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Traditionalist. Today's date is Monday, the 10th of April, 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Today, I'm joined by the host of Mysterium Fasces, Florian Geyer, to discuss all the news of importance to white people. Florian Geyer, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. It's a beautiful beginning of Holy Week here in Canada. It's summertime weather. It's come early. So I'm very pleased to be on the podcast with you today.
Yeah, so it's a beautiful day here as well. Beautiful spring day. I do like it in April. It's supposed to rain a lot in Britain during April, but the last few years it's been quite sunny. I appreciate it. I don't like it when it gets too hot and sunny. I'm quite a northern type of person that doesn't like too much heat. I'm sure you must be the same, being over there in Canada.
Yeah, well, yeah. When you the town I live in, you deal with 190% humidity, 30 degrees Celsius in the summer. So I know how it feels to boil.
Yeah, we like our extremes. We like our extremes, being white people. Today, I guess we should get your analysis on what's going on with Donald Trump and Syria.
Right.
We've already heard Matt Heimbach, Grandpa Lampshade did a special podcast on it. SS Britannia with myself and Subal, we're discussing it a bit. And so far, everyone that I've spoken to about this has had a different take on it, a different view. So I'd very much like to hear what your views are on it are, actually. So let's start with that.
Okay, well, my general impression on this would be, here's kind of the way I see it. I don't think that Donald Trump was a shill from the beginning. I mean, if he was, it's, you know, that's kind of some far and away, you know, incredibly long and deep masterful scheming, which I just don't see as being realistic because of the incredible grief and monetary loss that was caused by his campaign. But from what I've seen now is it appears to me I don't buy into the whole 4D chess hypothesis. I think that Donald Trump launched this attack on Syria and is ramping up actions against the regime of Bashar al-Assad in order to harmonize himself with a neoconservative foreign policy. And we're seeing this as well in things like you know, the removal of advisors and replacing of generals and this sort of thing. I think he replaced McMaster with or Flynn with McMaster, who is you know, a notorious neocon and things of this nature. So my general overall impression is I think that this is kind of prima facie seems to be almost what it appears. I think Donald Trump is going along with a neocon foreign policy agenda. Now, that's about the boldest that I'm willing to get into any kind of truth claims here. You know, is it possible that this is sort of a display of force in order to dissipate and distract tensions, you know, within the regime so that he can then move into Syria and destroy, you know, the Israeli-sponsored ISIS with no qualms from his own military-industrial complex? Yeah, I mean, it's possible, and we'll see if that's what happens or not. But it's also possible that if he is being leaned on by the neocons, and that is why he's done this, well, then that means that he's going to be able to be leaned on again, that whatever something has happened, something has shifted, that they're able to pressure him into doing what they want. And if that's what has occurred here with his strike on Syria, which is what I think is the most likely possibility, then that means that this could happen again. There's no stopping it. When the attack first happened, I was talking with a bunch of different gentlemen, and we essentially, my personal opinion was that the way the situation would evolve depended on internal response within the United States and the response of Russia and her allies. From Russia, we've gotten an unequivocally strong response, which I did not expect. I thought that Russia would kind of try to back off and look for a more diplomatic agenda, but Russia came to the table with Iran, with Hezbollah, with Bashar al-Assad and said, "No, you cross the red line in the sand, any further military incursions will be met with force." by any country. So not just the United States, this is also directed against Israel. However, that is being said, I think that you sent me some articles, Sven, which I think raise some interesting questions as to the seriousness of this commitment. Because if this is the case, how come, you know, the nice S-300 and S-400 anti-ballistic missile systems that are stationed all over the military installations in Syria didn't shoot down these Tomahawk cruise missiles? Why were these Tomahawk cruise missiles only about 50% effective? Why did they only basically inflict light surface damage to this base that they were ostensibly trying to destroy? I think that these are legitimate questions, and I don't have strong answers for them, and I think that it's, you know, they sort of do point away from the initial reaction would be that maybe something is deeper going on here. But the thing that for me, and then I'll give it back over, the thing that for me that the biggest reason why I think that something nefarious is occurring in terms of Trump foreign policy is because this is exactly the opposite of what he ran on and promised to do as a populist candidate. So the winning move, he ran specifically based on building the wall and deporting them all and ending wars for Jews, foreign wars. And so the fact that he's, you know, made this huge overture in getting back into foreign entanglements and had his Secretary of State reverse his policy on the Assad regime in Syria within the course of a week based on gas attacks, which I personally believe are fabricated, but even if they weren't, even if it was just a stupid move on the Assad regime, you know, I think that this is very, it seems like he's shooting himself in the foot with his base. So that's my take.
Yeah, it's quite concerning, the shuffling around that he seems to be doing with the people that are close to him, removing Bannon from the Security mm-hmm. Council. I heard there was somebody else from Fox that was removed from their position. That is concerning, and just how close Jared Kushner seems to be to him and the influence mm-hmm. that he seems to have. All these sort of things concern me. What happened in Syria just seemed to me to be a show of force, and not a particularly good one. He could have really gone gung-ho and taken out lots of places. He didn't. Basically, it was just, look, we've got these weapons, we've hit the base, and that, I think, will get... It seems to have got the neocons on side. I'm not sure if he's aligning himself with their agenda or whether he's saying his loyalties are to these neocons. He's trying to get them on side. I don't see any evidence of further engagement. I don't see any desire to start a war in Syria, which was what he promised not to do. I mean, he promised not to get involved in any more wars in the Middle East. And this seems to me more like a retaliatory strike, similar to these drone attacks that keep going on all around the world, but they're not mm-hmm. actually acts of war. And one thing that I do question, I mean, Israel have actually gone in there and bombed Syria quite a few times. They've sent planes in, they attacked a nuclear facility, they've attacked an army base, and yet that was never described as an act of war. Russia didn't suddenly say, well, that's it, if you attack Syria again, that's an act of war, we're gonna all unite and fight against you. They just seem to allow that, which just seems very, very strange to me. It just seems like a reprimand against Assad, really. And I don't think there was any I obviously don't think there was any sarin. I think that's a ridiculous story that Assad had any sarin. I don't think there was any gas in the bombs that he dropped. But if you look at the actual official report, the official report says that they targeted that area because it had chemicals in it that were being shipped to Mosul. So if you drop bombs on chemicals, the chemicals are going to go off. If you've got civilians in that area, the civilians are likely to be harmed by that. And that's going to cause loads and loads of bad publicity, which is why I think Assad made a really stupid move there to do that, basically. He's just basically handing over this bad publicity to the world to use against him. And they've exaggerated it and said that he used chemical weapons and what have you. And it surprises me that that people, even though we've got this report which says they targeted the area because it had chemicals, people are still looking for it to be fake footage and for it to be fake and as if there weren't really any victims. Because Syria and Russia have both admitted that, yes, there was chemicals there. That's exactly why they targeted it. So, and I just think the response to it has been very over the top. It's as if, that's it, he's made one mistake, that's it, we'll throw him under the bus, we don't want him anymore. And I think that really wouldn't be helpful. If he was to lose all his support, all his populist support, then he would, I think, move over to the neocons and the old Republican agenda that we've always had up until now, because he wants people to like him and to like what he's doing and to support him. So I do think the response to it has been a little bit over the top. And also, I don't think people should place so much faith in one man solving all their problems. I mean, we know democracy isn't going to solve our problems for us. I mean, the best that Donald Trump can do is put a wall up and slow down some of this immigration, stop focusing the intelligence agencies of America against nationalists, which is a really positive thing. I mean, don't forget that he has stopped the intelligence agencies from being agent provocateurs in white nationalist organizations. They are now purely concentrated on Islamic organizations. So there are these positive things that he can do, but he's certainly not going to be able to turn around the last 70 years. You think 70 years worth of brown people flooding into the United States, 70 years worth of miscegenation and brainwashing, he's not going to be able to turn that around. And he's not a racial nationalist anyway. All he's going to do is slow down some of this immigration and make conditions slightly better for Americans. So when he does a stupid move like this and goes and attacks Syria, we should expect him to make mistakes and to do daft things. We shouldn't believe these memes that he is the God Emperor. I mean, they're all very tongue-in-cheek and ironic. That's the way that I've always seen them. But it seems that some people have really fallen for it and were really heartbroken to see this.
I think there's several critical points. Number one, I would say, is that I'm not committed to any narrative here. And I think that it's important that we remain open on the subject, because nothing is set in stone. There's a whole bunch of ways that this situation could resolve itself, and your perspective might very well prove out to be correct. But I think that what this situation does is it brings up a few underlying points that I think you've touched on that I think are very critical. Psalm 146 says, "Put not your trust in princes, nor in the sons of men, in whom there is no help, for his breath goes forth and returns to the earth, in that very day his thoughts perish." And I think that this is the classic mistake, is that we think that these princes, these populists, these great leaders are going to come and save us from the swamp of our own decay. And ultimately, that's not the case. That what I've been saying for a long time is that the reason why we've gotten to this position is because we've allowed ourselves and our peoples to atrophy in terms of their spiritual life, in terms of their virtue. And this is the thing that needs to be addressed more than any other cause for the downfall of our civilization. And so, you know, any populist candidate that is playing on the desires and wishes of a degenerate people is not going to help us in the long run. Parliamentarism is not going to help us in the long run, because this is part of the same system which has brought us to this location. And so I think that we need to continue to understand that Donald Trump is not the God Emperor. He's not even Adolf Hitler, not by a long shot. And that ultimately the burden of success or failure rests on our shoulders and on the shoulders of our children and their children. And those are the areas of our lives that we need to be focusing on with the greatest intensity, because that's the foundation that will see us victorious in the end and in the long run, because we might have to fight this battle for another 1,000 years. It's very possible. So I think that that's an important rebuke to make. I think that a lot of people are kind of, this is like a wake up call for them. It's like, oh, you know, parliamentarism is wrong. You know, the only way forward is, neo-Nazis fighting in the street. And I think that there is some legitimacy to that. I would not go so far to say as it was a mistake to support Donald Trump, and we should have supported Hillary Clinton for purposes of accelerationism. I think that's ridiculous. I think that, as you pointed out, there is good infrastructural benefit that comes from Donald Trump being elected. There's certainly less pressure on us that gives us more room to operate. The propaganda coup that the far right was able to engage in because of the Trump phenomenon, I think overall was positive in terms of getting our message out, in terms of radicalizing people, in terms of these very real and important components of our struggle. But we have to, as you said, go back and understand that this is not the end, and we need to extricate ourselves from this slave mentality of being boxed into one candidate or one parliamentary system. That's not how life is. You know, ultimately, National Socialism, Christianity, is about life. You know, and life is not quantifiable in systems of ideology. Life is about the survival and flourishing of our people.
And whatever state system that we have has to reflect what we see around us in nature. It has to have a hierarchy. It has to be based on one ethnicity. And the whole party system, where you have different parties arguing about who's going to be doing the best for what people, is a nonsense. And you really don't want to have a choice between different parties. I just want somebody there who is going to be doing the best for white people, in my particular case, who's going to be doing best for British people, who's going to put British people first in everything, not one group which says they're going to do the best for the rich capitalists, and one group that says that they're going to take from the rich capitalists to give to the poor, another group that says that they're going to allow everyone to have extreme personal freedoms, homosexuality, pedophilia, and all the rest of it. Yeah, I don't want that. I just want somebody who is going to be doing what's best for the British people, and they know that if we actually had that, then everybody would want to vote for them. I think it's actually illegal to do that over here in Britain, to have a party that specifically looks out for the needs of the white British people. And it's perfectly fine to have different organisations that look out for blacks or look out for Jews, but we can't have any organisations that specifically look out for white people. And that's what we need. That's what nature is. The fox looks out for the fox, the sheep looks out for the sheep, the duck looks out for the duck. You don't have the fox looking out for the needs of the sheep and the chickens. They have to look out for themselves, and we have to look out for themselves. This was another point that I really wasn't very impressed with. So many people were saying, well, this is it, that's the end of Donald Trump. And I was thinking, but well, hang on a minute, this is something that he did in Syria. This is something that he's done to another group of people entirely. And our priorities should be to white people. America's priorities should be specifically to white Americans. And what he does in other countries should be low down the list, and it should be balanced against what he's done for white people. And what he's done for white people so far, I think, outweighs what he's done over in Syria. Now Matt Heinbach pointed out that yes, that may be true, but we also have to support nationalist organizations and other nationalist groups around the world, which includes Syria and it includes North Korea, and that's fine. Yes, we should support these other nationalist groups, but our own race and our own people should always come first. And if it comes down to it, we've got to support the white people, and we've got to support Trump if he's doing positive things for white people, more so than if he's doing negative things to Arabs. And hopefully he's not going to start doing negative things to Arabs anyway. I think this is just a reprimand.
Yeah, well, you know, all of those points are correct. I mean, it ought to be taken for granted by people in the far right, but unfortunately that does not seem to be the case in many instances. Ultimately, just to refocus it on what the takeaway message is no matter what occurs, we have to understand that this is about our people. And ultimately, parliamentarism, presidents of the United States, of the crumbling late successor to the Roman Empire, in the long term will not secure a future for our people. And so I think that that's always needs to be the cornerstone, and the point of orientation is how is this going to help our people now and in the long run? You know, and then after, obviously, the we want to see world peace and the flourishing of the different peoples and all that, but that has to be secondary to the, you know, immediate survival of ourselves. And so it's just that you think that these would be basic, easy points, but unfortunately, they're not.
Well, I think the natural system, the right system that we had was a monarchy. We had a hereditary monarchy that was based on hierarchy. It was based on eugenics as well. It was based on a specific bloodline, and the best person of that bloodline was taken to be the king. And our kingly lines all got ruined, basically. They got destroyed. They became interbred with Jews. They became toppled. Puppets were put in their place. So we ended up destroying that system. So then we needed a new system, and Adolf Hitler arose from among the German people, and he pretty much had the powers of a king, and he was pretty much looked at as the king. I mean, he could do whatever he wanted, but he was held responsible for everything at the end of it, and he took his life at the end of the war. Because of that, he fell on his sword in the way that the king should fall on his sword if his country gets taken. So I think the closest we have to the natural system that we once had is National Socialism. I mean, that was basically a reaction.
Yeah, I agree 100% with everything that you just said. You know, I mean, I think monarchy is ideal, and I think that is, from divine and natural law, this tends to be the essence of what a healthy governing system is, especially, you know, obviously there's different applications in different countries and different nations. But I do think that in the, pragmatically in the modern times, I think that some form of revolutionary national socialism or fascism is the only realistic option in order to apply the urgently needed medicine that our countries require to ensure their short and medium term survival. So yeah, full agreement with me there, and I think that that's most especially Christian national socialists that I talk to have a similar position.
Well, it's always a focal point, isn't there, in nature? If you have a flock of birds or a pack of animals, there's always one. There's always one top dog, the alpha male, with a harem around him or with a whole troop around him. But there's always one that's the most important focal point that everything else sort of revolves around. If you look at the hive with the bees and you've got that one queen bee in the middle there, there's always one focal point. And I think nature produces these focal points and we were in tune with that before. We could see that somebody was blessed by God, and they were the one that should be the royal family. And we had castes, we had eugenics, we had a eugenic system. All the while we had kings and classes and castes, we had a eugenic system, and we had equality within those castes. Because you had everybody that was a merchant caste, everybody that was the bardic caste, and they were all of a certain equality within that caste, but the whole of society wasn't equal, because you can't have everybody equal. You can have, you know, groups of equal people that are on equal footing with one another. So if, say, you had the bardic caste and you had one that wasn't particularly good at it, he could be measured up against the rest of them. And they could tease him about it and encourage him to be better. And that's a positive thing about it. But you can't have the whole of society equal. Everybody
is
precisely equal.
And I think this is important. And this is, for me, one of the major and critical attractive things about traditionalism and national socialism, the idea of class collaboration. And probably most of the listeners here are familiar with the way that we use class, but we don't mean this kind of Marxian, you know, how much money you have. We mean it in terms of your function in society. So there's a military class, a ruling class, an administrative class, a bardic class, it's a farming class, etc. You know, that are grouped together in a corporate personality, in a guild or in a union or in a, you know, Mosley in his 100 questions asked and answered about fascism describes the establishment of these kind of social corporations in order to deal with these different classes of people. And I think this is a very important idea, exactly as you say. And I think it's great that you mentioned that the idea of a monarchos, from Greek, mean mon, one, and the arkos, ruler. This I think is, if you're a Christian, you believe that this is built into the very fundamental nature of the universe. If you were a Christian and you believe the Gospel of John, then that means Jesus Christ himself in his divinity is the cosmic order, the logos, the rational and ordering faculty behind the universe that in fact directly created everything that exists. And so all of creation bears the stamp of Christ, and it all points back to him. It's all referential towards his nature in one way or another. And so traditionally, this is how monarchy was seen, is that the monarch is an icon of Christ's kingly nature and is anointed with oil and the Holy Spirit. In Christendom, it was a semi-sacral position. It was almost an eighth sacrament. For Orthodox, on the Sunday of anathema, when we read the anathemas against heresies and things like this, we specifically anathematize people who say that monarchs are not anointed with the Holy Spirit.
Well, the monarchs have to obey the laws of God as well, don't they? I think it says that in the Old Testament. They have to obey these laws. They're not to increase their horses or invade other countries. They're there to look after their flock, and they're there to set an example to the people. They have to be of high moral standing because the rest of the nation looks up to them. And we've had times in Britain we had monarchs who were gamblers, who were drunkards, and the rest of the nation would follow. The rest of the nation would start drinking gin and get drunk and gamble all their money away and get into debt, because this focal point that you have, this king, he's the prime example. He should be the example of how people should behave. And the king that we actually beheaded, Charles I, I think he was, he wrote down we haven't got much of his writing, but he wrote down a list of the attributes of what a man should be and the attributes that he should have. And it gives you a real insight into the guy's character. And he was a really virtuous, upstanding man. It's terrible that we beheaded the guy, and all our problems in Britain specifically came after that. And that was when we allowed the Jews back in and gave them the Bank of England. Yeah, I mean, this guy, this king, he was a champion of the poor. The poor really liked him, but the nobles and the landed gentry, they wanted to get rid of him. They wanted more power for themselves, which is what democracy is. It's a way of usurping the power from the monarchy and falsely pretending that it's handing power over to the people. And it's not handing power to the people. It's handing it to the bankers.
Precisely. Yeah, I think this is all very important. You know, today is the first Monday of Holy Week. It's great and Holy Monday. And on this day, we celebrate, when our Lord drove the money changers out of the temple in Jerusalem, the scourging and the cleansing of the temple. We celebrate also the withering of the fig tree. And I think these are both very important points for us. I mean, certainly that parable is not, not a parable, that event is not new for any of us. But this is essentially what occurs with the demise of monarchy and the rise of oligarchy, is that all of the things that are good and right and natural, the sacred institutions, rather than being focused on the spirit, on things that are transcendental, things that orient us towards meaning which is outside of space and time, which is eternal, it becomes subservient to contemporaneous political circumstances, unfortunately. And so I think that we always have to keep in focus that our political reality flows down from our spiritual reality and not the other way around.
So that's an important point to make, I think. It's the same with everything. This battle, it's a spiritual battle that then manifests as a physical battle outside of us. We have to defeat our inner demons before we can defeat the outer demons. Yeah, and just what you mentioned there, the cursing of the fig tree, I think that was symbolic of the Jews as well, the actual fig tree itself. Was that on this at the same time that he drove the money changers out?
It depends what the gospel traditions have a little bit different in terms of their chronology, but yes. And this is the if you read the Gospel of Mark, this is how it begins: is John the Baptist in the desert, crying, "Make straight the ways of the Lord," and he says that the axe is laid up and the fires are ready, and every tree which does not bear good fruit will be cut down and cast into the fire.
Yes, even now the axe is laid at the root of the tree. Yeah, great stuff. Thank you very much for coming on, Florian. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Messerschmitt. We hope you have a great day. Hail victory.
Hail victory.
You've been tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArian.com.